over plans to close some station ticket offices and move 800 staff to other jobs. Tube management dispute union claims this will compromise passenger safety. Commuters elsewhere face treacherous journeys to work. Heavy snow and ice have closed hundreds of schools in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Northeast England. The UK is shivering under the coldest November on record. Overnight temperatures drop to 1 degree Fahrenheit, and the forecast for the rest of the week even colder and more snow. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Irvin Kershner, who directed The Empire Strikes Back, among other films, has died. A family friend says Kershner passed away Saturday in Los Angeles after a long illness. He was 87 years old. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, a website for teachers and the public to explore the pros and cons of controversial issues.
Anne Hathaway and Jake Gyllenhaal co-star in the romantic drama Love and Other Drugs, in which they share several nude scenes. On the next Fresh Air, Hathaway tells us how she knows when a nude scene works on screen.
Are the actors invested in it? Do they seem uncomfortable? Do they look like they're self-conscious about what they're doing?
Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Today at 1 p.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Support comes from the U of I College of Applied Health Sciences, presenting Redefining Disability, New Directions in Research and Practice on Thursday, December 9th from 12:30 to 5 p.m. at the Alice Campbell Alumni Center. Speakers include Brad Hedrick, Gene Driscoll, and Dr. John W. McDonald. Advance registration ends December 1st.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. Well, there are many Americans who have fond memories of sitting in front of a screen, television screen probably, maybe a movie screen, but certainly a television screen, and watching Charlie Chan, the Chinese detective, the man who spouted aphorisms that sounded kind of like they might have come off of a fortune cookie. To many Asian Americans, though, Charlie Chan is a particularly nasty example of a racist stereotype. Our guests for this hour, Yunte Huang, who's professor of English at University of California, says, in fact, that Charlie Chan is really a more complicated and interesting figure than that would suggest. And he says, one thing that a lot of people don't know is that Charlie Chan was at least in part based on a real person, a legendary Honolulu police officer named Chang Apana. This morning in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Yunte Huang about the real man and also about the fictional character and perhaps what both have to say about America and the collective experiences of Asian Americans. And these are some of the themes that you will find in a recently published book. The title of the book is Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. W.W. Norton is the publisher, and it is out now if you'd like to read the book. And the author is indeed our guest for this morning, Yunte Huang. He is now an American citizen. He was born in China. He's been here in the United States since 1991. He has taught at Harvard University, and currently he's professor of English at the University of California, Santa Barbara. And he's joining us by telephone. And Professor Huang, hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
We appreciate it. As I mentioned, you did not grow up in the United States. You grew up in China. And came here in 1991, I believe.
That's correct.
And apparently your introduction to Charlie Chan was in the printed form. You came across a couple of old copies of Charlie Chan novels. What was it that attracted you to them?
Well, you know, that was in Buffalo in 1994, about my third year in the United States, and I found these two books at an estate sale in Buffalo. What immediately attracted me, obviously, just like, you know, the same things, I guess, that attracted millions of, you know, Charlie Chan fans was his sense of humor, really, the aphorisms. But also, as a character, you know, like he's later, you know, we can talk about them later on, some of the other kind of eccentric detectives, such as Columbo or Hercule Poirot, they're very eccentric, you know, they seem to, you know, they play dumb, but actually they're very smart. And that's kind of the trickster figure that immediately kind of, interested me.
And I don't know if at the time were you aware that for many Asian American scholars that this was he was such a contentious figure?
Absolutely. I actually, you know, I found them almost at the critical moment when he was announced pronounced to be dead. You know, Charlie Chung is dead. That was the campaign that was being waged at the time, and for very good reasons, because I think Asian American writers in their earlier, decades, they encounter such enormous, obstacles. So there's certain necessity, historical justice, for them to announce that Charlie Chung is dead. Yes, I was fully aware of that.
Yeah. And it's, I suppose, one of the interesting points here, and it's something that you deal with, is that for a lot of people, they might see Charlie Chan as being Chinese. But the point that you make here very strongly is that Charlie Chan is not Chinese. Charlie Chan is American.
Yes. And that's something about American culture that Charlie Chan embodies that, deeply kind of fascinates me as a cultural historian, really. Mm. He's a, as I will put in the book, he's as American as Jack Kerouac, that French-Canadian hipster who transformed himself into an American hero. So Charlie Chung is really the Made in America hero.
He was the subject of six novels. And again, I'm sure we'll talk more about Earl Der Biggers, the man who wrote these. These are six novels that were published between 1925 and 1932. They were quite popular. And then there were a series of movies that were also quite popular.
Right.
And I wonder, do you account for the popularity of this character given the fact that there certainly would have been at the time a lot of racism, and it wouldn't have been that much before that there actually were, well, perhaps this goes back to the 19th century, but there were exclusionary laws that were aimed at keeping Chinese out of the United States.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Charlie Chung is such a complicated case, either like, I would say, a Chinese box or a Russian doll that has layers and layers of, meanings and complexities. So he emerged really at the critical moment of 1925, as you said. The year before that, 1924 was a critical point in American history because that was the year when the Congress passed the Johnson-Reed Act, which is, after 1882, Chinese Exclusion Act. 1924 Johnson-Reed Act was really one of the major kind of legislative, bill that effectively restricted, if not simply stopped, immigration. It restricts immigration from Southern Europe, Eastern Europe, Italians, et cetera, but also effectively stopped Japanese. So and Charlie Chan, he's very exotic. He's charming, but also very exotic. So he appeared, stumbled on the stage at the critical moment when we basically legally kind of, close the door to so-called foreigners. And there we go, a foreigner shows up. So this is a paradox, obviously, a paradox in American culture that we need to unpack and to ask why. And there are many explanations, if you could bear with me just for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, Charlie Chung, as an iconic Chinaman, we have to go back to, as you said, 19th century, when Chinaman was really a neutral term when Chinese first, came here. But only after anti-Chinese, sentiments gained currency after the gold rush, because of the competitions and minefields, et cetera, they turned against Chinese, and Chinaman became a negative term. And Charlie Chung, when he appeared in 1924, the U.S. has already effectively stopped Chinese immigration via that 1882 law. So, he compared to the previous, the earlier kind of iconic Chinaman Fu Manchu, Charlie Chung was really is a friendly character. He's not harmful. He's actually protecting, the the U.S., et cetera. So he's, he's lovely, funny, and I guess that's why, that's part of his baggage, really. And but there's another reason for, this love and hate relationship with Charlie Chung for America. is that the yellow face performance, you know, especially when he shows up on the silver screen. As you know, there were three, actually, to be historically correct, you know, three Asian actors played Charlie Cheung first, but somehow, you know, it didn't work. And there came a Swedish actor, Warner Oland, who made a name for himself first in the 1927, you know, Al Jolson's Jazz Singer. He played the Jewish cantor, the father figure. And he made a main name for himself, and then he went on to play Fu Manchu, the evil Chinaman, and then he became this kind of a good Chinaman. And so a lot of people today who objected to Charlie Cheung really objected to this you know practice of the yellow face performance, and that of course says a lot about racism in Hollywood.
Well, here you touched on something that I think is very interesting, and that is that Charlie Chan is, in a sense, the flip side of that is, in popular culture, people really only got two kind of images of Chinese. One was the evil genius Fu Manchu and his minions and people like that. But here, this was a different sort of image, a more positive kind of image, and perhaps that was the reason that Asians in China, for example, really took to Charlie Chan, because it was a more positive figure. It was a person who was on the side of justice. I think even Ki Luke, who was the Chinese-American actor who played the number one son, actually defended Charlie Chan from the criticism, because he said, look, this is actually a very positive character.
Absolutely. I mean, if you watch the movies, you know, who is really the butt of the joke in these movies? They're usually, you know, the white captains of police who, you know, look down upon a Chinaman who as a detective. They started out with a lot of skepticism over his ability to solve anything, basically. But, of course, they were humbled, you know, humiliated by, you know, their experience with this great, you know, Chinese detective.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Yun-Te Huang. He is professor of English at University of California, Santa Barbara, and he is the author of the book Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. It's published by W.W. Norton and looks at the character of Charlie Chan in print, in film, how it developed, and also, and we'll talk just in here just a moment, about the man who seemed to inspire, at least in some part, inspired the character. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk, Illinois@illinois.edu. Well, I think we should go on to talk about Chiang Apana, this man who was a police officer in Honolulu in the early 20th century, who, at least in part, and we talk about this some more, but at least in part seemed to have inspired Earl Der Biggers to create the character of Charlie Chan.
Right. To give a brief account of his life, and he really led an extraordinarily legendary life. You know, he was born in Hawaii. His father was a Chinese coolie laborer who came to work in the sugarcane plantations in Hawaii. And he went back to China with his parents at age of 3, and then he came back to Hawaii at the age of 10. He actually grew up in the same grew up in the same county as Sun Yat-sen, you know, the founding father of the Chinese Republic. Mm-hmm. But at any rate, he later on in Hawaii became a paniolo, which is the Hawaiian word for cowboy. So he learned the you know all the skills. He joined the police force in 1898. Just when Hawaii was annexed by the United States. And he almost immediately became a local legend because he will walk the most dangerous beats in Chinatown carrying a bullwhip that he designed himself. And he didn't need to carry a gun. He was actually the only police officer in that department who was allowed to use you know, a bullwhip as a weapon in place of a gun. And at one time, he single-handedly arrested 40 people. And according to contemporary accounts, you know, he was able to, like, fly from rooftop to rooftop like a human fly. And one time he was thrown out of a second-floor window, but he somehow managed to land on, you know, on his feet and walked away like a cat, really. So So he was a really local legend, and that's why he became an inspiration for Charlie Chan.
Mm. It's a great story, and it's clearly that the introductory section of the book was your writing your version, and I'm sure that you had a lot of fun writing it, of this story where he went into a gambling den all alone, had only his whip, right, and he arrested 40 people, and they all went along quietly.
Exactly, yes. Because he's, you know, the mentioning even his name will really elicit shudders into the spines of a lot of criminals. In because of that, you know, the mighty weapon he carried around is really mightier than a gun, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
And he was also a master of disguise. Like in this episode that you describe, you know, he disguised himself as, you know, and he will put on, you know, he was actually the first undercover cop for the Honolulu Police Department.
This would make a great movie. Today, fortunately, he would no doubt be played by a Chinese action star like Jet Li, somebody like that, I'd say, would be just right cut out for playing this man.
Yeah, certainly.
To shift a little bit here to talk about Elder Biggers, he was a writer, an American writer. He was born in Ohio. He went to Harvard, as you did. He worked as a journalist. He wrote fiction. He wrote plays. And his interest here in setting stories in Hawaii first seemed to just grow out of the fact that at one point he was overworked, he was worn out, and a doctor said, "Well, I think you need to take a vacation." And so he went to Hawaii and soaked up the atmosphere there. And at least initially, probably he must have thought, "Well, this would be a good place for me to set a story."
Mm-hmm. Correct. Well, he was sitting on the beach, really. You know, today, if you go to Waikiki, that place today is called the Gray's Beach. And he was sitting there looking out at the ocean. It was getting dark. And then he saw a big ship, you know, docking in the harbor. I think the ship was too late to pass the customs at the time, so had to, you know, anchor for the night. And then he thought, wow, what would be a great idea to write a you know, detective, you know, story about a killer who will, you know, swim, who is a great swimmer, who will swim from the ship and then, you know, and come on shore and kill somebody and then went back, and that would be a perfect alibi. So that was the beginning of The House Without a Key, that novel. And Charlie Chan appeared as a minor character. Almost like one-third into the book, Charlie Chan, the Chinaman, you know, appears. And after the publication of The House Without a Key in 1925, Biggers was flooded by, you know, by letters from fans, readers, say, you know, when are you going to write the next book on Charlie Chan? So then he realized, oh, man, you know, I'm now, like, married for life, you know, uh-huh, to this Chinese character. And that's why in the next novel, that Charlie Chan appears as the central character.
And for Elder Biggers, this was the beginning of quite a successful run. Charlie Chan made Elder Biggers a wealthy man.
Absolutely. And he was able later on... you know, his health didn't really get any better because he was a workaholic, and so he had to move to Pasadena, California, and where he bought a house. The house actually still stands today. But the fascination for me about Biggers was this question. When I went to Warren, Ohio, a small town in Ohio, when I went there to do, you know, for a field trip to look at the town, to look at neighborhood, you know, cities, et cetera, what intrigued me was this question: how in the world can somebody coming from, you know, a small town in Ohio, how was he able to describe a Chinese so vividly? You know, mm-hmm, where does the fascination come from, and where did he get the sources, etc. You know, so that's really, we're talking about, you know, 19th century American craze, you know, for the Orient.
Well, that, again, it does raise this interesting question about where Elder Biggers gets this character. And you talked about how he was vacationing in Hawaii and something about the atmosphere it grabbed him so that he thought, well, this would be a great place to set a mystery story.
Right.
But then also, though, he said, later on, he said that he was in the reading room of the New York Public Library, and he was reading through some old Hawaiian newspapers, and he came across a story mentioning Changapana, and that he said, well, this really inspired me to create this character. Now, you went to the library and you asked them about it, and actually they said, well, we don't actually think at this was in 1924. We don't actually think we had any Hawaiian newspapers then. So it sounds like Earl Dirbigers, at least that story, he just made it up.
Right. Well, I think he has kind of just his memories foggy. And so, like, as you described, you know, did a lot of research in order to verify that story. It turns out it's like, you know, the fifth ace on the river. It's kind of fishy. But anyhow, so regardless of where and when he came across, you know, the name or the story of Chiang Apana, there's really no doubt that, you know, Charlie Chiang was inspired by Chiang Apana. As to how closely these two characters, you know, resemble each other, we have to, you know, that's a great topic for us to explore further, really. Yeah. Mm.
And he, as the books and this character became more popular and more widely read, people in Hawaii read these books and they knew about Charlie Chan, and they actually started to identify Charlie Chan with Chiang Apana.
Uh-huh, yes. And so Chiang Apana was really celebrated, you know, as a local hero, but also as the real Charlie Chan. So when he, you know, at the time walked down the street, kids would chant, you know, Charlie Chan, Charlie Chan. And he would gladly autograph, you know, E.D. Bigger's, you know, Charlie Chan novels for anybody. You know, the tourists will come to Waikiki, you know, and Apana will autograph the books for them, you know. Mm. Although he was actually illiterate. He was not able to read and write in English or Chinese.
You also apparently found, I think, was it you who found that when you, again, asked this question, well, where does this character come from and what inspired it, that there actually was a man named Charlie Chan who ran a laundry in Akron, Ohio?
Correct.
Do you think that's where Earl Dirbigers came up with that name?
That's possible. On the other hand, Charlie Chan is a very common, you know, Chinese name in the 19th or 20th century, you know. So, but that laundryman certainly... Once again, we are talking about, you know, I write about in the book that, you know, I was reading this, you know, St. Louis Main Street. There was a Chinese lantern, you know, that also appeared in the middle of this kind of, you know, typical mainstream small town America around the turn of the century. And that lantern came from Chinatown, San Francisco. So to me, you know, the creation of Charlie Chiang out of that kind of, you know, middle West origin really speaks to the strength or the depth of, you know, Orientalism or exoticism of 19th century America. Mm.
It seems also from the very start, if you look at the character of Charlie Chan that appears in this first book, House Without a Key, that he was in maybe not completely formed, not fully formed, but was. It was the Charlie Chan we recognized, particularly in the way that he spoke.
Right.
Where does that come from?
Well, you know, we have to go back to really the 19th century racist literature, let's say, about Chinese. The typical kind of centerpiece for that literature was really, you know, Bret Hart's, you know, The Hidden Chinese, published in 1871, you know, in which there's a Chinese character named Arsin, you know, S-I-N, and you know what it means to call somebody Arsin. But anyhow, Arsin was Bret Hart put it, you know, has ways a dog. He's very cunning. He was playing this, you know, this game called the euchre, and he pretended to be a beginner. It turns out, you know, that he was a much better cheater than, you know, Bill Nye, who was an Irish, miner. So, although Bret Hart, to his defense, he wrote the piece really as a, you know, as a mockery of Irish racism against Chinese. But for some reason, the readers took it as a mockery of Chinese, a caricature of Arsin. So this is a huge historical irony. And in this poem, you know, it's very typical that Arsin would speak a childish language, you know, pidgin English or broken English. And Charlie Chiang, because he also speaks this sort of pidgin, and that made him a kind of a representative of this kind of stereotype against Chinese.
Our guest, again, let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Yuntae Huang. He is a professor of English at University of California, Santa Barbara, and he is the author of the book Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. It's published by W.W. Norton. The book is just out. Questions, again, a welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. We're about at our midpoint of this hour of focus. After the novels started to come out, maybe about midway, and were quite popular, eventually Earlder Biggers and Changapana met when Biggers was in China, or was in China. No, it was in Hawaii. It was in Hawaii, yes.
It would have been great if they met in China.
Yeah.
But, although, you know, the stage was set in many ways. And I used the word stage deliberately because, you know, they met on July 5th, 1928. The second day, actually, Biggers arrived in Hawaii. He immediately went to meet up with Changapana. And they met in his Royal Hawaiian Hotel, which is, you know, one of the greatest hotels in Waikiki. And they met up, they took pictures, and they were very fond of each other, respected each other as well. They talked through an interpreter who is Changapana's nephew. And so they sat for photos. But what's funny is that when the photo which was eventually released was actually not a picture of Changapana and Earlder Biggers, but it was Earlder Biggers with somebody who pretended to be Charlie Chan or supposed to be Charlie Chan. I did a little research, and that man who was supposed to be Changapana or Charlie Chan, I think he was actually a bellboy of that hotel, you know. But he looked definitely a lot more, you know, Charlie Chan-ish or Chinese to the camera.
You know? Yeah, in fact, you have the picture of, in the book. Here are the two men. They're sitting in wicker chairs, and the man who is the allegedly Charlie Chan is wearing a long, elaborate Chinese robe.
Right.
So he's dressed in character, but other than that, he doesn't particularly resemble Changapana, not that much, it seems, but maybe a little bit, but certainly not like the Charlie Chan that we came to know.
No, I mean, the book also has the real picture of Changapana and the Biggers, as you see. In that picture, Changapana, you know, is still looks like a cop, and he's kind of, you know, killer look in his eye, although he's really an old man already at the time. So, you know, he doesn't really look Charlie Chan-ish, for that matter. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Also, when at one point there, in one of the movies, they did shoot in Hawaii, and Changapana visited the set. You also have a really nice photograph in the book of Changapana and Warner Oland together.
Right. Uh-huh.
So here we see the Charlie Chan of film, the one that was the Swedish actor who became the big success, being Charlie Chan in character, standing with Changapana.
Correct. And that was in the summer of 1931, the making of Black Camel. And that was actually the first on-site production of any Charlie Chan film, you know, on-site in Hawaii. And the crew invited Changapana to attend the shooting. And he went there almost every day. He was really, you know, thrilled to be there. And he really, you know, as at New York Times, you know, a reporter was there. And he eventually wrote an article for the Times in which reported on, Changapana's laughter, roaring laughter, when, Charlie Chan or slash, you know, Warner Olin said in the movie that, oh, you mean you want me to have a lie detector? You mean wife? Well, I have one, you know, as a lie detector. And Changapana, that really cracked him up, you know. And Warner Olin, you know, to say a little bit about him, he was so good at, you know, playing Chinese. He was good at playing a Jewish cantor. He was good at playing a villainous Chinese, and now he's very good at playing a good, you know, Chinese cop. And he went to visit, you know, he went to visit China in 1936, and he was mobbed in Shanghai and Beijing, you know, by fans and journalists because they just loved him. And he actually was so serious about, you know, learning Chinese that he studied the language, read up on the philosophy and art and everything. So at the news conference in Shanghai, he was able to deliver a few passages in Chinese, as he would do later on in some of the movies.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, he died quite early. You know, he drank himself to death, basically. Yeah.
That was, yes, he was an alcoholic. It was rather sad. Actually, though, it connects with his character because apparently his one of the things that he did before going in front of the camera was to have a couple of drinks.
Exactly.
And that that kind of mellowed him out a little bit and slurred his speech a little bit. And it actually that was his way, one of his ways of finding the character of Charlie Chan.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, my so-called at his ease. And this became funny because later on, Sidney Toler, the second, you know, major Charlie Chan, you know, actor, and the producer made him drink as well before, you know, the shooting, and all with the same purpose, to slow down his speech a little and to put this kind of perennial, you know, grin on his face. And I guess that's why, you know, the third Charlie Chan actor, Roland Winters, probably because he didn't drink, and his Charlie Chan career was relatively short. Yeah.
And what you write in the book is that he was maybe the least successful at playing Yellowface. That is, the other two guys were, and Warner Oland actually earlier in his film career had played Asians before,
right.
That Winters was maybe the least successful at convincing audiences that he was in fact Asian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he just needed to drink, I think.
There were some Asian characters who did play supporting roles in the films, and a little earlier I mentioned Ki Luk,
right.
Who played the number one son in a lot of these movies, and who was someone who actually defended the character of Charlie Chan in the movies because he said that it was actually a positive kind of role.
Right.
Did many of the Asian actors who were involved in these movies, the few of them that were, say very much or leave something of a record about what they thought about these movies?
Well, you know, we have to look at Hollywood culture as a whole at the time because it was a very problematic, I mean, it was a golden age of Hollywood. On the other hand, it was also a very problematic period, you know, when you talk about like people like, you know, Anna May Wong, who actually played, you know, in Chinese Parrot, one of the Charlie Chan movies, mm-hmm. which, you know, the screen, you know, the reels had not survived, unfortunately. But, you know, so that was the period when, you know, Asians, because of the production code, you know, that forbids basically interracial love or kissing, et cetera, you know, people, great actors and actresses like Anna May Wong, you know, Ki Luk, were not allowed to play leading roles. And I guess that's also, you know, the Charlie Chan baggage, is that the Asian American, you know, hatred or, you know, dislike of Charlie Chan was because of that problematic Hollywood history.
Yeah,
that's undeniable, obviously.
Yeah, it's interesting. You were talking about just how popular Charlie Chan was in China, and about how Warner Oland had this huge hero's welcome when he arrived in China, that they apparently didn't feel quite the same about Anna May, who had her career really built on being this exotic sex symbol.
Right.
They didn't think that was such a positive image. They thought Charlie Chan was okay, but they weren't as happy with Anna May.
Right. I mean, that has also something to do with sexism. You know, the 1930s was not. There was a, you know, feminist, you know, freedom or liberation kind of movement in China. On the other hand, you know, there's very strong tradition with sexism in Chinese culture. So for somebody like Anna May Wong to become, a sex symbol in Hollywood, to a lot of Chinese was simply unacceptable at the time. In comparison, however, you know, you have a Warner Oland, a Swedish actor, although playing a Chinese stage, you know, on a global stage, I guess, that's welcoming, you know, news to Chinese. So it's quite complicated. But, you know, there's a follow-up to, you know, to Warner Oland's visit to Shanghai and Beijing, was that, you know, it really triggered, you know, the Chinese film industry, made them produce their own Charlie Chan films. And, you know, the reels have been lost. But according to contemporary accounts, you know, the leading actor of Charlie Chan, the Chinese Charlie Chan, he will really imitate, you know, Warner Oland in walk and talk and everything. So we are talking about a real Chinaman, you know, imitating a Swedish imitation of a Chinese, for that matter.
Mm. Yeah. We have a caller here. Let's talk with them. Someone who is listening in Indiana on our toll-free line, yeah. Line 4. Hello.
Yeah. Hello. Sorry, I got a chuckle in there at the end. You were talking about somebody doing this, somebody doing that. I think it's a marvelous thing for multiculturalism, those movies. I've got all of them. I take them off of Turner Classic Movies. And I come down to the place where in certain movies I like Olin and certain movies I like Toller. But Winters was just a lousy actor. It had nothing to do with anything other than he's just a rough actor. If you see him in other movies and stuff, he just doesn't have any kind of presence at all. I wonder whether or not this sort of thing could be done otherwise, too, in that one could probably get some sort of course, at least for one semester, where one could check these things out, particularly with the movies, other kinds of odd relationships, like a Swedish guy playing a Chinese, playing a detective, and you certainly get Anna Wong. I mean, I understand her situation. She was a very nice girl in the movies, that's for sure. That's all I just wanted to say. Brought back some good memories. From childhood, actually, and from I taped all these things, so I see them over and over again. They hold up very well, and I always thought there was a sly smile. Now that you've talked about the alcoholism, it's sort of taken away some of my viewers. But I always liked Toller's sort of looking at everything askance, like even the camera occasionally. He'd be playing to it. I always thought they were just well done movies, actually, and I'm glad that you got involved in it. And in a sense, the credentials even get deeper. You being from China, it's all the whole thing's interesting to me. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, I think the caller particularly points to something that maybe is part of the appeal, and it goes back to maybe something that you said at the beginning about how detective characters, they're all very eccentric, and that's one of the things that attracts us to these characters, whether you're talking about Charlie Chan or Sherlock Holmes or Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple or whoever. It's their eccentricities that attract us. That in the case of Chan, though, that there is always this feeling that that the people around him are underestimating him, and that he has this little look that tells you that he actually knows more than he's letting on, and he certainly knows more than these people think, and that that indeed may be part of the appeal here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the caller brings up two things. One is this exactly the eccentricity of detectives, Columbo, who talks nonstop about his wife, who doesn't really exist, and Sherlock Holmes is a heroin addict, and Hercule Poirot walks these kind of funny penguin steps, et cetera. On the other hand, the caller also brings up this question about yellow face, this racial ventriloquism, performing the other, and that's really always part of American culture, a very problematic part of American culture that goes way back. We are talking about blackface. Early on, I talked about, Jazz Singer. That's one of the major films of blackface performance. It's Al Jolson, performing, so-called Negro numbers, right? And we also talk about red face, playing Indian.
Sure.
It's a long American tradition.
Sure.
And now you have yellow face. So, of course, all these racial acts of racial ventriloquism, we probably cannot imagine what American culture will be like without all these kind of racial ventriloquism. Undoubtedly, they carry this, racist legacy. On the other hand, there is also, as I will put it in a book, the creative genius of this culture.
Yeah.
So you cannot throw away, either one for that matter. And then that's why I think Charlie Chan is so interesting.
Well, and that's, I guess there's something else that we haven't talked about, but you certainly do write about in the book, that in some of these movies featured performances by two African-American actors that I think, that I know a lot of people today find particularly painful to watch.
Right.
Stephen Fetchit and Mantan Moreland,
yes.
Who were actually, they were African American, but in a way they were doing blackface.
Mm-hmm.
They were doing these stereotypical black characters that you saw in many movies,
right.
of the period, mm-hmm. and that I think that there are probably some people who would find it harder to watch that than to watch Charlie.
I know it's often strangely, this becomes sort of kind of defense of Charlie Chan. People would say, like, look, the blacks look even worse in this movie, so you should be happy as a Chinese, you know. At least you guys have a hero. But I mean, don't really buy that argument. Yeah. But to me, you know, both these Afro-American actors, they're really great in this movie. You know, as one Afro-American historian, film historian put it, that it's not, you know, yes, you know, that's the, you know, racism in Hollywood, you know, that created a very negative environment for these artists. But it is equally important for us to realize what these great actors did with these stereotypes. You know, oftentimes, Stephen Fetcher's performance, I will argue, is actually an attempt to undermine these stereotypes because, you know, he made the stereotype basically unbelievable. Mm-hmm. And that will make you think again, you know, whether or not, you know, you will buy that kind of stereotype. And I think it's the same thing that's happening with Charlie Chan. You know, he plays so dumb. He plays dumb, you know, but actually he's very smart.
One of the things that of course, are associated with Charlie Chan are these Chanisms, these aphorisms, these things that he would say. Uh-huh. And I had an email from someone here who was wondering, well, were these things, were they made up? Did Earl Der Biggers just make them up, or screenwriters make them up, or were they somehow more genuine and had a better pedigree than that?
I guess the easiest answer is to ask you, where do you think the, you know, fortune cookies today, you know, who wrote the fortune cookies today? Do you think Chinese wrote them? Probably not. But there's an interesting anecdote here. Well, to answer the question, you know, everybody made them up. You know, first of all, Earl Der Biggers, writing the novels, he collected many of them, translated some of the Confucian aphorisms, and he made up some himself. And later on, the films, the scripts, you know, the screenwriters will also, you know, come together and write up a few. But actually, in publishing this book, you know, at the back of the book, I have a list of Charlie Chanisms. There are about 50 of them. When I first, you know, contacted 20th Century Fox to ask for permissions to quote, you know, I got a sticker shot, you know, when they asked how much it would cost me to quote.
Uh-huh.
And the answer was $250 a quote, you know. And I was really shocked because, you know, that's about the price for you say, if you quote a line of T.S. Eliot or Emily Dickinson, that would cost you $200 or $300. And so I told the person at 20th Century Fox, I said, you know, I'm shocked. On the other hand, as Chinese, I'm really happy because now, you know, the Oriental wisdom has acquired such high price. I'm happy as Chinese. But then eventually we negotiate down the price. So now, you know, as I will put it, this is actually $20 a laugh, you know.
Well, and people can make – they can turn it into a parlor game. They can make up their own. And I'm sure that people did after having read these stories and after having seen it at the movies. They caught the idea, and I'm sure a lot of people made up their own.
Uh-huh. Sure. That's the nature of aphorism, you know. You make up a funny thing, right?
You, as you say in the book, and I'm sure that people would appreciate, fortune cookies are not Chinese. For a long time, if people went into a Chinese restaurant, the food they would get was not Chinese.
Right.
And so, as we said at the beginning, Charlie Chan also is not Chinese. All these things are in large part American. Mm-hmm. So in what sense is Charlie Chan American?
If he's not Chinese, then, you know, he got to be American, for that matter.
Oh, well, okay. Are there other aspects of his character, though, that you think were particularly American?
Oh, yeah. For instance, I mean, to give you a very small example, that his dislike of Japanese, for instance, you know, it shows up in the novels and it also shows up in the later movies made during World War II. You know, Charlie Chan really bears the stamp, you know, the American stamp of his time. You know, as I said early on, 1924 Johnson-Reed Act targeting, you know, Southern Europeans, Eastern Europeans, but also mostly Japanese, really. And so Charlie Chan really, you know, inherits, that kind of, you know, anti-Japanese sentiment, for that matter. So that's one indication he's really American, you know.
My experience with Charlie Chan comes completely from movies. I have not read these novels, but one of the things that I remember about the movies is the relationship between Charlie and his children, or at least the one that we saw a lot. We saw a couple of them, I think, but particularly we saw Key Luke, who was very Americanized and was famous for for bursting into a room and saying things like "Holy cow, Pop!"
Yeah, you know, G-pop.
That's G-pop. That sort of thing. And which always, as far as Charlie was concerned, was a little. I guess he wasn't quite sure exactly what to make of him. What in the books, particularly, but also in the movies, was there some exploration of culture clash and any sort of a serious thought about what it meant to be an American or about assimilation?
Sure. Well, ironically, you know, in the novels, his sidekick was a Japanese, Kashimo. And he appears only in Black Camel, the 1931 movie I talked about. And as for his kind of the question of Americanization, Charlie Chiang in the last novel, Keeper of the Keys, you know, he runs into another Ah Sing, although it's S-R-N-G, who is the housekeeper in the novel. And so they run, you know, into each other. And Charlie Chiang had a moment of skepticism, kind of self-doubt about, you know, his own Americanization. He was saying something like, you know, looking at Ah Sing, you know, who has been in this country for about, you know, 20 or 30 years, and he's still, you know, as Chinese as he was first born. Whereas me, Charlie Chiang said, you know, I carry this kind of, you know, the mark of Americanization. So he sort of, you know, he thinks about that, you know, and mm-hmm. he's well aware of that as well. And that moment of, you know, of self-reflection was really picked up by some later Asian American writers, and they look at this as really a moment of identity crisis. You know.
I have an interesting email here from someone who's been listening and notes that you said something about how is it that a man from Warren, Ohio could create a character of a Chinese man so accurately, and went on to say it should be made clear that by the time that Seven Keys to Bald Pate was written, which I think was his first big success, that Biggers had lived in Boston, and I think maybe we mentioned it at one time, maybe I just mentioned in passing that in fact he had been at Harvard. Mm-hmm. So he lived in Boston, he lived in other larger cities than Warren. In addition, the listener says that Biggers was constantly gathering data for his stories and was a keen fact gatherer, given his having worked as a manuscript reader for Bob's Merrill in Indianapolis. His wife, Eleanor, apparently even referred to him as, quote, a Middle West product with a Boston complex.
Right, yes, yeah. Thank you. That's a great quote, actually, yes.
Anything else you might want to say about Earlder Biggers?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the fact that he lived in Boston, I think, was crucial. I mean, my question was talking about somebody's origin. It's like talking about my origin, for instance, how I learned English at the age of 11 by listening to VOA, illegally, et cetera, et cetera. And now I'm writing a book about an American hero, for that matter. So sort of kind of, therefore, you know, Biggers, you know, experience of growing up in a small town really kind of resonates with me. And to go back to Boston definitely is the mega of U.S. Orientalism. We're talking about the Boston Brahmins who went to Japan, you know, lived in Japan, you know, of Ernest Venalosa, Henry Adams, et cetera, et cetera, Lafcadio Hearn, you know, all these people who went to Japan and brought back, you know, Japanese artifacts, you know, art and calligraphy and the literature, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, absolutely. You know, Boston was, you know, Biggers definitely got his first taste of Orientalism in Boston, if not earlier, you know, in his small town.
Yeah. And yeah, and certainly Harvard has been for a long time a very important center for Asian studies in the United States.
Correct. Yes.
Did he do any of that kind of thing at when he was at Harvard?
Not really. He was more kind of addicted to popular culture, really. You know, he overlapped for a year with T.S. Eliot. But, you know, if you can look at the literary careers of these two writers, you know, they couldn't be more different, you know. T.S. Eliot became a high modernist, kind of elitist high modernist, although he was also very fond of, you know, the Orient. And Biggers, however, as a popular writer, you know, he will write stories, and he has also his own brand of Orientalism. So we're talking about, you know, the fascination with the East, you know, both high and low in American culture.
Mm. Coming now, we've got just a couple of minutes left, and some people, I'm sure, will be pleased by the memories that are elicited by the conversation. Some people maybe not. Some people perhaps it would lead them to think a little bit differently about this character, or at least maybe reconsider just a bit. But I wonder for those people who just say that Charlie Chan's just irredeemable, how it is that you would respond.
Well, one of my missions with writing this book is really to look at the racism and the culture in America today, really, because there's a lot of racism out there. But for some odd reason, we cannot, you know, talk openly about these issues without, say, shouting and yelling or staying angry quietly. And that's really a pity. And I think, you know, with this funny character, Charlie Chan, he may be a good start for us to readdress these taboo issues. So I think he definitely, you know, deserves a second look. And so, you may be surprised, you know, at what you find.
So you think that it's a character that still has some resonance for people today and not just as a cultural artifact of a bygone era?
No, I don't think so. Because to me, you know, he creates this kind of another kind of, well, let's say, image for Asian, especially men, is that he is funny. And one of the stereotypes against Asian men or Asian people is that it's so-called inscrutability. Mm-hmm. Charlie Chan is inscrutable, but actually he's very funny. And so I think his humor should undo, you know, this kind of sense of inscrutability. So, like, look, you know, Asians, you know, are very funny, actually. You know, they're not inscrutable. They're actually funny if you can get their jokes. And we are fond of a joke, you know, of a good joke as much as the next guy, for that matter.
Yeah. That inscrutability thing, I suppose that goes back to the idea that if someone's inscrutable, it's perhaps because they're alien, because they're so different from you that you can't even imagine what it would be like to be in their head, or you can't get into their head, and that's what that seems to be about.
Right, but on the other hand, you know, the millions of people who love Charlie Chan, I don't think they feel that Charlie Chan is irreproachable. Mm-hmm. He's exactly so approachable that he's so funny that, you know, you get his jokes, and therefore he's actually quite friendly and charming.
Mm. You know, I proposed earlier we make a movie about the life of Chang Apana, and my first choice is Jet Li, so we would agree on that. Could you imagine someone today doing Charlie Chan?
Yes, some people have proposed that Zhao Yun-Fat, actually, as, you know.
I like that, too. Yes, yeah. That would be, yes, he would be my Jet Li for Chang Apana, but Zhao Yun-Fat, my first choice.
Yeah.
I think that could be very interesting. I don't know whether such a thing could happen, but I think it would be very interesting.
Uh-huh, yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time. We certainly appreciate it.
Well, thank you, David.
Our guest, Yun-Ti Huang, he is a professor of English at University of California at Santa Barbara, and his book, which is just recently published, is Charlie Chan, The Untold Story of the Honorable Detective and His Rendezvous with American History. The book is published by W.W. Norton. You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Support for today's broadcast comes from Community Blood Services of Illinois, providing all donated blood for patients in Champaign-Urbana, Charleston-Mattoon, Danville, and Effingham. There are no substitutes for donated blood. Blood donation takes 45 minutes and saves lives. Information at 367-2202 or on the web at bloodservices.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at SubaruofChampaign.com or 352-4700.
It's 2 minutes before 12 noon at Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. I'm Tom Rogers. It is Monday, and coming up on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll have Europe Today from the BBC, as well as the latest news from NPR, the BBC, and AM 580. The markets look at the moment as if they're rather flat to the wheat. Actually, some increase in the wheat today, And soybeans, some weather concerns have brought the market down a little bit. The December wheat contract in Kansas City is standing right now at 7.30 a bushel. That's up 9.25 cents. The March at 7.45 and a half, up 8.75. In Chicago, the December wheat contract is up 5.5 cents at the moment at 6.53 and 3/4. March wheat at 6.93 and a quarter. That's up 6. And the May wheat up 6 as well at 7.18. The corn pit looks like this. December in Chicago is up a penny at 5.39 and a quarter. March corn at 5.54 and a quarter, up a penny and a quarter. May is at 5.62 and a half, up 1 3/4. July at 5.66 and a half, up 2 1/4 cents. The crude oil trade for January in New York right now is at $85.33 a barrel. That's up $1.56 at the moment. RBOB gasoline for December is at $2.27 and 3/10. That's up 6 3/10. In the bean complex, January nearby beans at 12.35 and 3/4. They're down 2 3/4 cents. March at 12.44, down 3. May at 12.46, down 2.5.